Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Leigh Brooks for the economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. George Michael, a prophet of our age, like all the icons on the side of the angels, why do angels like him all seem to keel over prematurely? Israeli armed forces launch a series of attacks against not ISIS, but the Syrian Arab army. What happened exactly? And more to the point, why haven't we heard about this on the UK news? Plus, infiltration, not just of companies and charities, but any organisation that stands against the New World Order. We hear from the long-time environmental campaigner, now retired and editing FRAC News, Frances Leader, about what she calls the five different types of infiltrator she's come across in her four decades of campaigning. Yes, and Tony Blair. The greatest war criminal of all time from Britain? Who knows? Well, back in 2003, singer and musician George Michael had a few things to say about Mr. Blair. Could he even have been something of a prophet for our time? And we hear an extract tonight from his appearance on the BBC's Hard Talk show from 2003. Pretty shocking stuff. And we look at the 1970s too, at the child abuse in the children's home in Kinkora in Northern Ireland. And from someone who tried to blow the whistle on it, eventually managing to, that his name was Colin Wallace, who worked for the British military. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon most Tuesdays, but you can be sure to catch it online this week. A look at the critics of the Israeli state at home and abroad. Jackie Walker is a suspended Jewish Labour Party member who spoke about the role of Jews in the early days of the slave trade. She's been suspended now for pretty much 2 years, but she's doing a play in Bristol, a one-woman play about her family and why she said what she said. And can a Jew be anti-Semitic? Also, from Stockholm, Sweden, journalist Chris Bollins, the author of Solving 9/11, he's accumulated evidence that dual American Israeli citizens may have been involved in perpetrating the 9/11 attacks. I ask him for the evidence. And in the cover-up too, that's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, hopefully, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Martin, we've had the airstrikes and what looked like standoff missiles, that's cruise missile strikes, against Syria by the Israelis, but very, very little, if any, reporting. I haven't seen it anywhere on the news here. So what's happened and why haven't we heard?
Well, I mean, it is out there. It's not as if people don't know about it. It's just not the sort of thing that you're going to see on mainstream news in Britain, which is still very much controlled information, basically, on Syria. There's still basically attempts to mislead people about what's going on, who's fighting who about what. What's interesting is that the Syrians haven't really retaliated. And I think what it is, the Israelis can actually attack with relative impunity, although they have fired back as they've come in. But they're not retaliating because they've got plenty of other people to fight. So the Israelis are just adding to the chaos. And of course, the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists have been coming in and out of Israeli-controlled territory, just as they've been coming in and out of Jordan, where the British are operating. And I was reading this afternoon earlier on South Front that various ISIS fighters are now being reintegrated into other units. And the Russian Ministry of Defence claims that ISIS fighters are being retrained by British personnel in Al Tanf. Now, in other words, the war is very complicated, but not as complicated. You know, one of the other things I was reading, they've got prisoners of war from over 65 or 85 countries, the Syrian army. So there are 5,000 people from Uyghurs from China fighting inside Syria to overthrow the Syrian government. But of course, having these people from all over the world fighting to overthrow the government has done nothing really to endear the revolutionaries, if we can call them that, to the local population. And they're losing the war.
Also, we've had this apparent drone swarm attack.
Yeah.
Russia's been talking about. But hang on, before we talk about that, I think we should really just be clear. What happened? I think it was beginning of this week, wasn't it? Monday or Sunday. And because I understand it was several attacks by the Israelis against Syria. Who was being attacked and what were they using?
The Israelis claim that they're...
It was all early morning stuff,
yeah,
about 3 in the morning.
The Israelis claim that they're going for Hezbollah-linked stuff. And there's supposedly, well, it's whispered that there's an understanding with the Russians that if they just go after Hezbollah-linked stuff, the Russians won't bring their air defences into play. But the Syrians, of course, have not necessarily party to that, and they have fired back at the Israelis coming over the border. But, of course, we're all on a hair trigger here. You know, aircraft are flying around over Syria, and at any moment a decision could be made by one of the people, either piloting the drones or the aircraft, to shoot at somebody else. And we've got a shooting war. I mean, in the 1982 war in Lebanon, there was worries that the Syrians would shoot down, Russian equipment would shoot down an Israeli plane, and then we'd be off to World War III.
So the Russians had a drone swarm attack on their base too, in Syria. I guess that's a Tarsus base
at Latakia.
Latakia base, okay. So a swarm of drones started to attack the Russians.
Well, what the Russians are saying is they managed to shoot most of them down and they managed to capture some of them.
They hacked some, didn't they?
They hacked some of them. They said
that means you can actually bring it down intact.
Yeah. And they've also said today that they've assassinated the people who sent them. But what they've also said is that these were not homemade drones. They're actually, they've been made at a high level of technological sophistication. And they said, we know who did it, and it wasn't the Israelis, and it wasn't the Turks. And, of course, there was an American spy plane flying around while they were being
used. So these U.S.
So in other
planes...
Words, without directly accusing the U.S., they are accusing
the U.S.
This
U.S. Plane is called a... I'm not even sure what this thing is. US P-8 patrol plane can fly around. I mean, it looks just like a kind of airliner, grey airliner with no windows in the sides, mm-hmm. With two engines, a sort of thing you might see taking off from Bristol Airport. But so that could be used to possibly control those drones. I suppose actually the drones could even be controlled from RAF Waddington or somewhere, thousands of miles away.
Yeah, well, I think what they've tried to do, let's just try and put the jigsaw puzzle together. These drones have been supplied to Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists. They didn't build them their own. I mean, the Russians are saying, no, these are too sophisticated to be homemade stuff. And we know that a foreign state was involved. And they said it's not the Turks and it's not the Israelis. So I think, if you think that through, that means they believe that the Americans were behind it.
So why are the Russians just being straight and saying we think this is the Americans?
Well, because they know that if they say it's the Americans, then they've got to take retaliatory measures. And if they do want to take retaliatory measures, and they might, they want to...
Well, maybe they have.
Well, maybe they have. That's right. We can both play the game of plausible deniability. The reason why they've put it in the hands of these Al-Qaeda terrorists. Incidentally, of course, the important thing for listeners to get is that the West is still cooperating with Al-Qaeda terrorists, as they always have been for many, many years. And, of course, the Russian general staff are very well aware that Al-Qaeda and the Western intelligence services are pretty much the same thing. There's a cutout involved. So it looks as if the rebels did it themselves, but in actual fact, they couldn't have done it without support from Western intelligence services, and particularly the CIA. And, of course, what they're trying to do is they're trying to mess up the end game, in what's going on. But I understand Erdogan and Putin have already spoken about this, and Putin's satisfied that the Turks were not responsible for what happened.
In the background to all of this, we've got President Xi telling his army not to fear death in a show of China's military might. President is telling Chinese armed forces to be capable of combat and sure to win in a move designed to bolster his political standing. This was reported by The Guardian. You can imagine the picture with President Xi standing on this giant sort of Soviet-style podium with tens of thousands of troops all in line beneath him. Do not fear death. Be capable of combat and be sure to win.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, what senior Chinese military is saying, we can't presume that this war in Korea isn't going to turn into a major war in which we're going to have to be involved. So we've got to be prepared for it. It's like as if North Korea was going on in France, I'm quite sure we would all be running around preparing for the fallout if it turned into a full-on fight.
Also, another fascinating, I thought fascinating story this week, how hackers could trigger nuclear war. Warning, weapons that rely on new technology are vulnerable to cyber attacks. The Chatham House think tank warns that Trident could be hacked or sabotaged. The paper says hackers could spread false information prompting a launch. Its authors say nuclear strategy often overlooks the use of digital technology. Well, this is the sort of thing we've been saying for years here. Chatham House, who are they?
Well, they're a sort of a very semi-official think tank. Which
I love your term, semi-official, because
they're not part of the government, but they might.
They're basically funded by private companies and banks, aren't they?
Yeah.
And they basically do foreign policy, but on for a some kind of privatised version of foreign policy. So they're in a position to know about hacking. I mean, they're because a lot of their private companies are doing it.
Yes, and I mean, Chatham House has been around for quite a long time.
It's also called the Royal Forums
in which, you know, the big cheeses get together and with the little cheeses and discuss.
It's also
strategy.
Called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. It was set up in a sort of parallel way as the Council on Foreign Relations was in the United States. Now, the idea is these organisations, I mean, this is my take on it anyway, Martin, is they stalk the Foreign Office, they stalk the State Department, and often when they're addressing a specific issue, they are massively more funded than the official government body to come up with, you know, this is why you should do this policy and that policy.
Yes. I mean, it's one of the conveyor belts by which, you know, the elite get the policies they want from the infrastructure which they see as belonging to them.
So what do you think, is it possible that there could be a... We did have, didn't we, the launch of a nuclear test missile from one of the Trident submarines that headed off in the wrong direction towards the United States. Could that have been hacked?
Possibly. I mean, the fact is that when it comes to a final showdown in warfare, what the Russians have been trying to show is that we can hack all of your stuff. And Hezbollah, years ago, when they were accused of assassinating Afikariri in Lebanon, they said, we don't really want to do this, but they gave a press conference where they'd hacked into the Israeli drone, which was flying over the scene, and saying, well, this is who killed Hariri, and we've hacked into the drone. But they didn't really want to show that, because the Israelis then realised that their drones had been hacked. And, of course, real modern warfare is all about digital technology. And so, for example, what the Russians did when the cruise missiles was sent at the airbase after the so-called chemical weapons attack at Idlib is most of those cruise missiles were simply diverted by hacking. And, of course, what you could envisage is that somebody decides to press the button to attack somebody, and then the other side just hacks all of the things and says, your instructions, missile, are to return to base. And then, of course, the people who've sent the missiles off, the missile comes straight back.
I seem to remember a James Bond film rather like that. But anyway, I suppose what we could be talking about here is Theresa May ordering Moscow to be nuked by a Trident sub in the Atlantic, and then that Trident missile then just landing in the middle of London, blowing London to pieces.
Well, yes, I mean, and everybody who's involved in this at a high level realises that this is a feasible
thing. So this is an old technology, but the hacking thing almost trumps it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's why you might want to go back to old technology, where you really just crank it up and
fire. So are there any examples of that?
Well, I mean, the Russians in general have the philosophy of what their electronic war capability seems to me to be mostly about is just knocking out the other side's electronics. So that they've got, they can't communicate. The USS Donald Cook, the spy ship, they just knocked out all the electronics.
That was
nothing worked.
In the Black Sea, wasn't it? I mean, yeah. Our studio here, I hate
to say it,
folks.
They did it again in the Baltic.
In our studio here.
Appeared in the Baltic, they did exactly the same.
Without the electronics, you wouldn't hear a thing. I can tell you that. Back in the old days, I suppose, it would have been valves and that kind of stuff. That still would work. But the integrated circuits all would get knocked out by these things. Mm-hmm. And also, if they don't get knocked out, they could be hacked into. Also, great series. I have to say this. Mike Rudin, I mean, someone who we criticised, Martin and I certainly, for many years, over his Conspiracy Files series, which was just basically a whole load of BBC cover-ups for the real criminals in various things like the 7/7 London bombings, the 9/11 attacks, the death of Princess Diana, the Oklahoma City bombing. He's now, it seems, had a fit of conscience at the BBC. He's done a series, three-part series called The House of Saud, A Family at War, three-part series which examines the Saudi Arabian royal family, and actually is in a very critical light.
Well, obviously, I haven't watched them, so I'm not quite sure whether they're as good as some people seem to say they are. But people I respect have watched it and said, you know, this is a much more robust piece of journalism than some of the previous stuff he's done.
What's the main problem with Saudi Arabia, then, in your view? And there's two more of these to come, by the way. They're on. I'll just tell you when they're on. They are on. So the 5th of January was. It's Fridays, actually. Friday evenings.
Yeah, well, I mean, and presumably they're available on catch-up for those who don't get them when they're first broadcast. I mean, I'm vaguely aware of what's in these programmes, but I haven't seen them. And I think what it suggests...
Okay, let's just hear it from you. What is the main problem with Saudi Arabia? Well, given that it was set up by the Brits, Saudi Arabia...
Basically, it's a puppet state run by a kind of extended mafia, which, you know, were put in power by the British and then taken over by the Americans to control a major oil supply and make sure that it, you know, and of course the Saudi Arabian role in OPEC protects the petrodollar, which allows Trump to carry out tax cuts and carry out military expenditure, and the stock market rises.
But what about the geopolitics of it are that the major opponents of the whole Crusader project, the Israeli state in the Middle East, are the Arab countries. And Saudi Arabia is supposed to be an Arab country. You would expect that Saudi Arabia would be a political opponent of Israel.
Well, officially they are. So, you know, MS, whatever his name is, the Crown Prince dictator.
MBS.
MDS. He had to come out with we don't agree with this recognition of Jerusalem thing. So it was a bit embarrassing from their point of view. But of course, what they are is they are touted by the West and were originally conceived of by the British as the leaders of the Arab world because they control Mecca and Medina. But of course, they are, in fact, there's no particular reason why they, the Al Saud family and their allies, should be in control of Medina and Mecca. And Saudi Arabia is essentially a glass pillar in the private sector. In the Saudi Arabia, I was reading the other day, only 15% of people working in the private sector in Saudi Arabia are Saudi Arabians. So the Saudi Arabian citizenry, Sunni citizenry, lives on benefits and handouts, and the work is done by foreign workers and Shias. And in actual fact,
isn't that a bit like Britain?
Well, no.
I mean, we've got lots and lots of foreign workers imported into Britain.
Well, no, I mean, but 15%, only 15% of the private sector is locals. Yeah, 85% are from somewhere else in the private sector in Saudi Arabia.
Anyway, also the excellent Middle East Monitor. They are creating new perspectives. That's what they say they're doing. But interesting story from them this week. Benjamin Netanyahu's son is boasting of his father's gas deal at a strip club. I'm not sure if he's necessarily following the Torah, visiting strip clubs and things. But anyway, a recording emerged this week of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's son, Yair, Y-A-I-R, boasting that his father has set up a $20 billion business deal for a businessman and gas tycoon, Kobi Maimon. And published in the Israel Television News Company, the report stirred renewed controversy at a time when Netanyahu is being investigated on allegations of corruption. The recording dates back to 2015, when during a night out, he and his friends were reportedly ferried from one strip club to another by Netanyahu's government-provided security. "Bro, you got to spot me," he said. "My dad made an awesome deal for your dad, bro. He fought in the Knesset for this." Yair can be heard saying in Hebrew, "My dad set up a $20 billion deal for your dad, and you're fighting with me about 400 shekels." That was apparently over paying for a prostitute. So this doesn't help Netanyahu, because there is all these allegations running through the Israeli courts at the moment about him accepting bribes of various sorts. And in fact, there's virtually unreported demonstrations been going on in major cities in Israel over this.
Well, I mean, he's a shady character, without a doubt, and his son obviously has an enormous sense of entitlement, etc. What I wonder is, how accidental is it that this has all come out? Or has somebody in Shin Bet, for example, who's hostile to Netanyahu, made sure that they got hold of this recording and broadcast it? But don't forget, everybody these days has got to be aware that anything you say to anybody, even in a strip club with the music playing, if they've got their phone switched on, then they can probably record it. And
Next week's dialect with Jackie Walker talks quite a lot about the whole sort of background to Israel and Israeli politics. As she's Jewish, mm-hmm. she does feel that it's her job and her ability to criticise the Israelis, mm-hmm. and she's been suspended now for nearly 2 years by the Labour Party for doing so. And one of the things she explains is that the media in this country is absolutely scared to death to report anything negatively about Israel. She talks in that interview to be broadcast around about midday, or I suppose about quarter past midday next Tuesday here on BCFM. She talks about when a programme is broadcast, that the BBC and others, they will get thousands, sometimes hundreds at least, of complaints, a barrage of complaints, as before the programme's even finished going out, if it's critical of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, and we know that the Israeli government, they talk about Putin bots and all the rest of it, but we know that the Israeli government employs thousands of people to sit there on social media slagging off everything.
So why have we? This is what I mean. Why have we heard about the Putin bots but not the Netanyahu bots?
Because it's all to do with mind control and propaganda and people management. I mean, you know, it's the things we're supposed to care about are the things we care, and the things we don't want to know about. We don't hear anything. We don't hear very much about what's going on in Yemen, even though it's clearly one of the biggest crimes going on at the moment. And that's because our military are involved in those crimes, in which tens of thousands of civilians have died. It doesn't really fit with our self-image, so we don't even talk about it. Although occasionally they have to mention, oh, blimey, all these people are dying, and we're involved.
Well, I can just say from a journalist's point of view, journalist's perspective, it's very difficult to get work if you're going to criticise. I mean, what happens is you get editors with a specific point of view, particularly right across London, and then you've just got to basically you've got to think to yourself as a journalist, well, what would the editor say, and sit down and say it. And if you say something which is critical of Israel, you might well find yourself in a situation where you lose your job. Now, the point being here that, you know, we're in a labour market now where you can lose everything if you lose your job. Yeah. There isn't really a proper social security safety net anymore. You could possibly find yourself one of these people who's been criticised by the businesses in Bristol for having their belongings in the city centre because they've been made homeless for one reason or another. So I just thought it'd be interesting to look at the sort of bigger picture here from 2008 particularly, and the bailouts, why there's just not enough money around and why there doesn't seem to be any proper regulation of the banks. So we're regulating people who are keeping their belongings in the street, in the city centre, but the people who are responsible for that, the banksters, are getting away with it scot-free. So let's have a listen now to one of the former banking regulators, William Black, who testified back in around about 2008, actually, or maybe a little bit before, over in the US, explaining why sometimes he, as an ex-regulator, had managed to completely stop these crises unfolding by actually prosecuting and jailing bankers, but why that is now not happening.
We stopped a non-prime crisis before it became a crisis in 1991 by supervisory actions. We did it so effectively that people have forgotten it even existed, even though it caused several hundred million dollars in losses, but none to the taxpayers. We did it by preemptive litigation and by supervision. We broke a raging epidemic of accounting control fraud without new legislation in the period 1984 through 1986. Legislation would have been helpful. We sought legislation, but we didn't get it. And we were able to stop that because we didn't simply continue business as usual. Lehman's failure is a story in large part of fraud. And it is fraud that begins at the absolute latest in 2001. And that is with their subprime and their liar's loan operation. Lehman was the leading purveyor of liar's loans in the world for most of this decade. Studies on liars' loans show incidence of fraud of 90%. Lehman sold this to the world with reps and warranties that there were no such frauds. Financial institution leaders are not engaged in risk when they engage in liars' loans. Liars' loans will cause a failure. They lose money. The only way to make money is to deceive others by selling bad paper, and that will eventually lead to liability and failure as well. When people cheat, you cannot, as a regulator, continue business as usual. They go into a different category, and you must act completely differently as a regulator. When we've gotten and said sad excuses, the SEC, we're told there are only 24 people in their comprehensive program. Who decided how many people there would be in their comprehensive program? Who decided the staffing? The SEC did. To say that we only had 24 people is not to create an excuse, it's to give an admission of criminal negligence, except it's not criminal because you're a federal employee.
Yeah, well, Peter Galbraith, who is the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous economist, he's at the University of Texas, and he's a bit of an expert on this, and he basically says that it is fraud, and if you allow fraud, if you think about it, if you allow fraud in the system, people who are not being fraudulent can't keep up. If you can't keep up with the bottom line of Lehman's who are involved in fraud, and Lehman's are getting away with fraud, then everybody else has to start copying Lehman's to stay in business. And that's why you've got to jump on it. And of course, in the 1980s, when the savings and loans scam, like Silverado collapsed with one of the Bush families on the board and all the rest of it, over 1,000 people were sent to prison. And that was in the Reagan era. But now, of course, nobody gets sent to prison, because if anybody gets sent to prison, everybody's got to be sent to prison, so nobody's sent to prison. Meanwhile, we're cutting benefits for poor people, while these other people who've been taking massive amounts of money from the taxpayer not only are not punished, they are rewarded.
Well, like literally today, yesterday, we've seen PricewaterhouseCoopers slapped with a 2-year ban in India over fraud there. That means that PricewaterhouseCoopers has to sever all contracts that it's got with companies in India, and now can't do anything for 2 years. We also heard earlier on about the role of KPMG in the Grenfell Tower inquiry, being also the auditors for companies that were supposedly or may even be up for being prosecuted as part of that inquiry. Here in Bristol, under George Ferguson, we had a volunteer from KPMG working very closely with George Ferguson in the mayor's office. We've now got KPMG in Bristol City Office with Marvin Rees. It's interesting that he seems to have been interested, Marvin, in getting rid of these various service directors, the senior staff in the City Council, but he's not got rid of KPMG from the City Council. We've also got them involved in auditing the Bristol Arena project and the Brabazon project and the Filton projects as well. So these auditors, it seems, are everywhere, and nobody really seems to do anything about them. But I mean, effectively, what he was talking about there, we just heard there from William Black, the US regulator, who was really telling people how they should be doing things back in 2008, but they weren't, how they'd done things before, is that what we're dealing with here is what he calls accounting control fraud. Now, it seems to me that auditors are the only people who are really going to pick up on that. And if the auditors are themselves crooked, that's the only way that you're not going to find out about accounting control fraud. That is supposed to be, the money that's paid to auditors is to stop that.
Yeah, well, if you look what happened with Arthur Anderson and Enron, and Anderson, because they were involved in covering it all up and making it, basically enabling it all, they went down the drain. But of course, you then end up with even fewer auditors who are going to be, it's basically an oligopoly of auditors, so there's no real competition. There's only a certain number of auditors you can go to. And the other thing, of course, is that the way it works is organisations pay these organisations to audit them, and they don't pay them to come in and say, you're doing this all wrong, you're criminals. So the incentive system is all wrong.
In China,
the auditors ought to be completely independent.
They should
come in and say, right, well, you're not doing this right. We're going to prosecute.
I noticed in China too in December there's a suggestion that KPMG may be stopped from acting in China because something to do with their medical auditing, state medical auditing in China, which KPMG were involved in. There was fraud going on there, so they're now talking about removing KPMG from China completely. In South Africa, the KPMG partners have been accused of contempt of court, also in Hong Kong. At what point are some of these KPMG directors and partners going to be arrested and tried by the police? Because it doesn't seem that any of these frauds, which appear to have been going on, that there's any action being taken on them whatsoever.
Well, the fact of the matter is, with all of this stuff, it's just a cost of doing business, isn't it?
It just seems to me so utterly wrong that people in the city centre with no belongings are the subject of action, where the people who are actually conducting the massive fraud on an international scale are just left to go free.
Well, I mean, that's the way the world works, isn't it? We know that's how it is. It shouldn't be, but it is. And The fact of the matter is that all sorts of criminal activity going on. But of course, the incentives within the system, if you get caught involved in fraud or rigging the LIBOR rate or whatever, nobody goes to prison. The organisation has to pay a paltry fine, but the profits to be made by playing fast and loose with the figures are enormous. So it's just, you know, occasionally they have to pay a fine when they get caught. And apart from that, there's no particular, it's just a cost. They just factor that in to what they're doing. And the whole system is crooked from top to bottom and has been for years, which is why it collapsed in 2008. And of course, it's still exactly the same now, if not worse than it was in 2008. The idea that it's somehow been cleaned up and we've all moved on is absolutely fatuous.
So anyway, at the top of the hour, I was talking about Tony Blair as the greatest British war criminal of all time. Now, that sounds like it might be an exaggeration. Can you think of anybody who was worse?
Well, Churchill did kill an awful lot of people in Dresden. He killed the Kurds. He was the first one to drop chemical weapons on the Kurds in
the 1920s. Didn't you do a podcast recently?
There was a huge famine in Bengal in the 1940s, which people think that he was responsible for the deaths. I don't know.
Podcast recently on, was it in Gallipoli?
No, on the Crimean War.
Oh, on the Crimean War. Tell us a little bit about that podcast. Who was it with and what did you talk about?
I'm trying to remember who. It's called the Priory Podcast, I believe. And
we'll put a link on our show page. But give us a quick process.
We were just discussing the Crimean War and its historical
context.
Okay,
when was it then? And what was it about?
The Crimean War was in the 1850s. But we were talking about the actual history.
Crimea now, of course, is an interesting point, isn't it? Because this was part of Ukraine, but then became part of, it's now part of Russia pretty much, isn't it?
Well, it always was part of Russia.
There was a big tension over it. Tension over it to this day. But
yes.
Anyway, tell us about the original Crimean War.
There was tension around the holy places in Jerusalem, which were then resolved. There was tension about whether the Russians could use the Black Sea and the Dardanelles to move their ships around, because Sebastopol was their major port. Anyway, there were various kind of beatings of chests and rowing, and basically the Russians backed down over most things. But by the time the Russians backed down, the fleets were already sailing, the British and the French, to join the Turks. And then they attacked Crimea because they couldn't think of anywhere else to attack them. They've arrived, they were originally going to fight in Romania, but the Russians withdrew, and therefore there was no reason to fight them in Romania, so they ended up fighting them in the Crimea because there was nowhere else to fight them. This is
just part of the long-running dislike of Russia. What is this all about?
Well, I mean, don't forget that at that time, you've still got the fear was that the Russians were going to take away India from us. That's what the fear was. The British, oh no, the Russians are going to take India off us, as if India belonged to us in the first place. And of course, there was all sorts of, the British invaded Afghanistan in the 1840s in order to stop the Russians coming in. And then, of course, the Afghans kicked them out. The British Army died almost to a man in that particular expedition. But I mean, these kind of tensions have been going on, whether Russia was communist, czarist, or modern, democratic capitalist, if you like. And, you know, these tensions are always there. You know, we're still living, you know, the fault lines are still active.
Well, they weren't not long after, were they? Because the Russians joined the British in the First World War as friends.
Well, indeed. And, of course, that's what can happen is, you know, the kaleidoscope turns and suddenly everybody's on different sides. It's you know, these kind of political games are still going on. Because most situations are more complicated than having one side who are the goodies with white hats and another side with the baddies with black hats.
Okay, well, we heard
the
last...
The reality is a lot more complicated than that.
We heard last week from John Perkins, the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, absolutely fascinating guy. And this week we're going to hear from someone else who was a critic of Tony Blair and George Bush and their policy towards Iraq. I mean, he was saying, effectively, wasn't he, that Iraq was there, last week, that there were a whole sort of series of moves made to try and control Iraq and to try and control Saddam Hussein, and that the first Gulf War in 1989-1990 was an attempt to just destroy his military so that they could then go to him directly in as an individual and try and persuade him to do what the the Anglo-Zionist Empire's oil companies wanted. And then he still wouldn't. So that's why they had to have this invasion in 2003 to take him out, even after having sending in the jackals and then managing not to actually kill Saddam Hussein, which they've been trying to do pre-2003. But anyway, let's hear another angle now, and it's from a very different kind of character to John Perkins. George Michael, the singer, songwriter, musician, who's speaking on BBC's Hard Talk back in 2003.
I'm scared about Mr. Blair's attitude to the future. I think we're at a watershed moment. September the 11th was the first part of this watershed moment, and this is the tail end of it. September the 11th was so obviously directed at America to provoke a response, and the response was supposed to be revenge. We've spent something close to, what is it now? So something close to 18 months trying to prevent that knee-jerk reaction. And if all it's been is delay, then what was the point?
Well, there wasn't a knee-jerk reaction, was there?
No, there wasn't. But you don't think this is...
There's been a properly considered reaction, consultation around the world, hasn't there?
Has there?
Hasn't there?
I don't see any consultation.
American politicians?
I see a lot of bullying.
Checking around the world?
Yes, but do you see them actually saying anything but terrorists? It's either the terrorists or us.
Your complaint is that there hasn't been a debate, but the newspapers...
No. My complaint was 8 months ago, was that there was no debate.
So you've had plenty of debate since then?
Oh, yeah. All of which is being ignored. That's my point. I'm here because I'm
ignored
proud.
Ignored by whom?
By the Prime Minister.
He's seen the need to go out and make the case for what he believes in.
Yes,
that's a response to the debate, isn't it?
Absolutely. And do you not think that his voters have told him they're not convinced by that?
Somehow.
91%.
The country is not united.
91% said without the UN, they didn't want to go in. Didn't you think that's close to unanimous?
You were so much aligned with Blair and Cool Britannia, mm-hmm. weren't you?
No, I wasn't. I never turned up at that bloody party. Excuse me. I was never going to be used that way. When I saw Tony Blair, I saw him in Islington before he got into Downing Street. Right, when he needed people like me, I saw him personally. I went and had a meal with him, discussed it, because my lawyer is a member of the Labour Party.
But you supported it, didn't you?
When?
Then.
The
Cool Britannia.
I've never believed in Cool Britannia. No, it's not. You're not talking to Noel Gallagher or somebody from the Britpop age. You're talking to somebody who started 21 years ago. Cool Britannia is a load of bollocks to me. I'll be honest,
sorry,
I've been
about
very
the language,
distressed
folks.
By Mr. Blair's behaviour for several years in terms of the way I think he's removed the idealism from politics by taking a supposedly left-of-centre party and calling it Labour or New Labour, and then basically saying that we have to be pragmatic. The left is really, in these overly consumerist times, the
he also said you had to have an ethical foreign policy, didn't he?
Absolutely, and absolutely, this is not ethical, is it? This is a Christian country with supposedly a Christian leader who somehow think that the answer to the future is preemptive action. Now, to me, preemptive action is every bit as dangerous a concept as the initial concept of creating the atomic bomb. And by the way, that was created for the same kind of deterrent purposes by the same nation. And I do not believe that this is any more safe than that.
You'd still vote for him?
No, I wouldn't vote for him. I would never vote for him again. Never vote for him again, because he's gone beyond the bluff. He's now bullying the UN on behalf of
bullying?
Mr.
Persuading,
Bush.
He would say.
What, letting... Well, I'd say bullying. You have to be... you cannot ignore statements like the UN needs to prove its relevance. You cannot ignore the fact that America could sit there and say, you either agree with us or you're irrelevant.
15 members of the Security Council, mm-hmm. unanimous, signed mm-hmm. up to Resolution 1441,
yeah, and it's
calling
obvious.
On Iraq
Why?
To disarm.
And it's for the
Is
same
that
reason. It, listen, it's the
Even
the,
Syria.
It's the same
against
reason.
Against all expectations.
It's the same reason, right, that they, if they pass this new resolution, which seems a lot more unlikely considering that France and Germany are completely saying there's no need for it, if they pass the new resolution, it will be for the same reason they passed the first one, because they are afraid of extinction. And to me, that is bullying.
What kind of Prime Minister do you want?
I don't want
a man who leads on his convictions.
I want somebody who leads on his convictions until the point that they're public.
Until the point that you disagree with
them. No, until the point that 90% of the public disagrees with them.
Well, that's the hard time. That's what he's paid for, isn't it?
Take
hard decisions.
Not to be a populist. You're not paid to put people's lives in danger and ignore their opinion on that very subject. No one is paid to do that. You're not paid to put people's lives in danger and ignore their opinion on that very subject. No one is paid to do that. Yeah. I have no sympathy with Saddam Hussein. I have no sympathy with him. He should be gone. We need him gone in order to stabilize the region. But you cannot do this at the moment when the entire fundamentalist terrorist network around the world is waiting for this to legitimize what they want to do.
How do you think you've contributed to the debate over Iraq?
Well,
I mean, if you take Shoot the Dog.
Sorry, that was George Michael there speaking back in 2003. I think just interesting sometimes to take a dip back, isn't it? You know, whatever it is, 15 years or so, Martin, to listen to what was being discussed and also to see what's now transpired in the region.
Yeah, and I think just a tribute to George Michael, who died over the Christmas holidays, and he always was an outspoken and honest and honourable guy, and we will miss him. Well, I mean, the points you were making there are pretty obvious. You know, it was a turning point.
Do you think people were conned by Blair? Because he seemed, I mean, he was originally a supporter, wasn't he?
Yes, and of course the point is that
it also make it clear he didn't die over these Christmas holidays. It was last year, 2016, December, he died.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, the point is that, Blair, you know, we've discussed his culpability in these matters many times on this show. It was a turning point. We shouldn't have gone to war in Iraq.
What was going on within your party then?
What was going on?
Yeah, John Smith.
Well, I mean, don't forget there was a vote in the House of Commons about the war in Iraq, in which the Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, resigned and spoke against the government, and in which Blair said to his MPs that unless he had a majority inside the parliamentary Labour Party, he wouldn't proceed, which was to put bullying, you know, basically trying to put pressure on his own MPs. And Clare Short agreed to support the war, which she then subsequently regretted. And if she had voted against Blair, then a majority of the Labour Party in Parliament would have voted against war. Now, that Blair could still have gone to war with Tory
Are
votes.
Are you saying that Clare Short was responsible for the invasion of Iraq?
Clare Short admits this herself. She says, I was wrong. I was conned by Blair. I shouldn't have done that, and I regret it. And I can accept that as an honest opinion from her. And I think that's the problem. You see, if a majority of the Labour Party in Parliament had voted against the war in Iraq, Blair could have had his war, but it could actually have led to the fall of the government, and it would have been clearly a Tory Blairite war, with the Labour Party absolved from responsibility for all the consequences that have followed, including the rise of ISIS and bombs in Manchester and all the flipping rest of it.
Well, at least your language is more moderate than George Michael's. Thank you, Martin. Now, we're going to go back before the end of the show. We're going to go back and look at some more international stuff. But before that, let's have a listen to France's leader, She runs something called Frack News. You can find her on Facebook and elsewhere. She lives down in Devon, and she's been an environmental activist for, in her own admission, 40 plus years. She's now retired, working from home. She's not disabled, but she's not very well. She can't get around very easily, but she can do a lot from her computer. And also, she's had a lot of experience at dealing with the various pressure groups, NGOs, and watching as individuals come in and try and disrupt those groups. So here's what she had to say to me a few weeks ago on Dialect about infiltrating groups and what to watch for.
Well, there are five different types, actually, Tony. There's the ones that come from the government. Those are usually police undercovers, and their main objective is to identify everyone that is involved and feed that information back to the headquarters, and then to target those individuals to literally find any dirt that they can from the past of that person, and then use that to ruin their reputation with other members of the group. They will set one member off against another by saying, this one said this about you, and then saying the same thing to the other person, and causing people to have arguments and fall out. They will get drunk or drugged out of their minds and cause us disrepute by misbehaving in such a way that everyone presumes that all of us are like that, just on the behaviour of one person. They'll get themselves arrested doing things that are completely illegal, again, to put us into disrepute. There are endless games that they play and continue to play. And this has been going on for decades. All the time I've ever known anything about activism, we've dealt with people.
Okay, so you started with the police there. Can you run through the others?
Yeah. The next one on the list is the people that are employed by the industry. In the case of the oil industry, these are usually very, very well trained, very experienced, and have been involved with the oil industry in the past, and are therefore employed by the oil industry to do pretty much the same things that the police undercovers are doing, but also to misdirect us and make sure that we do not find out some of the really important secrets, such as the exact chemical content of drilling muds and frack fluid. That's a heavily guarded secret throughout the world. And to ensure that we do not find out that those things are severely toxic and carcinogenic, particularly to also make sure that we do not form relationships with people that work in the oil and gas industry, so that we do not contaminate them with some truth. That's another thing that they particularly are very keen that we do not do, that we do not have any communication with those people. The next category are the hangers-on, the people that turn up to our events and camps simply because they want to rumble, they want to be fed, they want to make sure that their own income is secure for their drink or drug habits, so they latch onto us for those reasons. And also, there are the very sad individuals who are maybe homeless and are desperate for company, and they're not likely to be quite so disruptive, but because of their reputation and their appearance will give us a bad name. And then finally, there's the actors, and you find these associated with the media. You'll get a media van turn up with all the equipment and cameras and God knows what, but out of the same vehicle we'll get someone dressed as a clown or in other some ridiculous outfit who will start causing as much attention-grabbing behaviour as they possibly can, and they are then filmed or photographed, and that goes into the newspapers, creating an image that we are not serious, that we are a bunch of idiots, to create a disreputation, if that's not really a real word, but that's what they do. So that's the five categories. There's the police, the industry themselves, the people that are simply freeloading, those that are suffering in society, such as the homeless, and finally the media and their part-time stooges who cause trouble.
Well, I could be forgiven for wondering, Martin Summers, whether some of these campaigns are almost all constructed out of people who are infiltrating.
Well, during the 1950s, every single member of the US Communist Party was actually an FBI agent at one stage, because that's how. And we now know that there were hundreds of police infiltrators under Special Demonstration Squad. Some scores have been, they've admitted to, but we know that there were hundreds. So we can presume, I've been an activist for over 30 years, we can presume that virtually everything we've been involved in is infiltrated. And that's no reason for people to panic, or that we shouldn't not do our stuff. We've just got to be aware that that's the world we live in, and we've got to be aware of what goes on.
Looking also at some of the international news, amazing to hear that the Trump visit has been cancelled. He doesn't seem to want to come to Britain for some reason.
Not that amazing, because it's not in either his interests or
Theresa May's
interests.
Well, he's been everywhere else, hasn't he? He's pretty much everywhere else. China,
well,
France,
he went to Saudi Arabia, and he said he was really pleased because there were no demonstrations, unlike elsewhere where he's been.
But maybe he's told Theresa May, unless you can make sure there's no demonstrations in Britain and lock everybody up that might demonstrate.
Well, also,
from
Theresa May's point of view, she doesn't necessarily want to be seen to be too close to Trump, although I noticed today, earlier, that Sadiq Khan has said it's good that he's not coming and he's getting the message, and our glorious foreign secretary then went on about, we don't want to mess up the special relationship with the US with some jumped up popinjay who runs London Council. And of course, it's almost like he's addressing the words. He's got no sense of irony, has he, Boris Johnson? You're a plumped up popinjay and you're a foreign secretary. And as you can see, people can be mayor of London and then they can end up involved in international geopolitics.
And what about Trump's alleged comment about Haitians, derogatory comment about Haitians? Because I noticed that, this story's gone all the way around the world, but Trump's just saying, well, I never said anything like it. I mean, is this fake news or real?
Well, we don't know because we weren't there, unless somebody's got a recording of a transcript of it. We're not, this is a reported statement. So, we can take it with a pinch of salt. But I think it's interesting that he picked on Haiti, I think it was in El Salvador, and went on what SH1T countries these were. That's the allegation. And what makes me snarl with fury, because both countries are a mess because they've been occupied by the United States of America for decades. The first invasion of Haiti by the Americans was in 1915, I think.
So psychologically, what's going on here? If the president is insulting these countries for being a mess, and yet it's his own administration that over the decades that have made them a mess.
Well, it's the Americans that made those two particular countries a particular mess. They are entirely responsible.
But psychologically, what's
countries.
Going on? Why he seems to be saying the complete opposite of what he should be saying, which is, we're very sorry, Haiti, for making a mess of your country.
Well, no, they don't say that, do they? I mean, it's the narcissism of the US. Trump seems to be middle class Americans seem to be of the view that they're very generous and they try and help everybody and everybody's so ungrateful. But it's an actual fact, the petrodollar system allows the US to live way beyond its means at the expense of the poorest countries on the planet.
Okay.
And it's been functioning like that for decades.
Let's just run through a couple of other stories. The Israelis have approved 1,122 new settlement houses the last couple of days, and WikiLeaks Assange has been granted citizenship of Ecuador after all that time in the embassy. I think he should be given a medal and made the president of the British Association of Publishers or something, since he's probably one of the most well respected by people around the world, publishers anywhere on the planet, and yet there he is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy still. Also, the Treasury Secretary reckons that there's going to be some more on the Iran sanctions. Apparently, that although Donald Trump has signed off this bunch of Iran sanctions. He's waved them through, but it's the last time. Next time there's any kind of question about sanctions on Iran, that's what's going to happen, which is effectively economic warfare on the country.
Well, they've had economic warfare for years, so really what they're talking about is carrying on having sanctions on them. I was reading about the Iranian protests earlier, and it seems pretty clear that they started because of the withdrawal of subsidies for poorer people. And of course they got to withdraw the subsidies because that's part of the deal with the US to try and lift the sanctions, etc.
But they've got these individual sanctions now. Trump is doing this, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page. It's on Zero Hedge tonight. A whole bunch of it, specific individuals who are, and they give their passport numbers, who are sanctioned. I mean, they were doing the same with Russia, weren't they?
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, they're looking for a fight with the Iranians. The Israelis were pretty clear they want a war with Iran, and they want us to fight it for them. Do the British people want a war with Iran? And if we don't, perhaps we better tell the Foreign Secretary to defend our interests instead of Israel's interests and the US's interests.
OK, well, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Mukawi, who's just poking his nose around the door there. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Redland Fee Hance. Also to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects on next Tuesday at noon, we hope. Catch it now online, though, if you wish to download at dialectradio.co.uk. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from the 1990s from a band called ATB. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. But our station manager is trying to get the show moved out of its prime time slot starting at 6 p.m. So if you've got a view on that, please do contact the station. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Center.